Welcome to the program, everyone. You're listening to Connecting the Notes. I'm your host, Matthew Ray, and tonight on the show, we will be listening to the music of Annette Peacock. Miss Peacock has been composing music since a young age and broke into the New York music scene in the 60s through her work with Paul Bley and her first husband, Gary Peacock. She may be best known for her early work with the Moog synthesizer, becoming possibly the first musician to graft her voice into the device for live performance. Since that time, Annette has moved away from the synthesizer and into different musical landscapes, solving problems with music, as she likes to say. Annette Peacock was kind enough to talk with the show earlier this week, and we'll hear that interview and more of her music in the next hour. Thank you all for tuning in. Annette Peacock with the song I'm the One from her 1972 record of the same name. That album was produced using a prototype of the Moog synthesizer, a brand new instrument at the time. Annette, alongside pianist Paul Belay, were able to secure one of these synthesizers from Robert Moog himself. Their compositions and experimentations with this instrument can be heard on several releases between 1970 and 1973, including the record you just heard. Annette Peacock was kind enough to talk with us earlier this week, and here are some of her thoughts on acquiring and becoming familiar with this instrument and the recording process of the album I'm the One. Based on that album, you were experimenting with the Moog synthesizer, which was pretty new in 1968 or so that you started recording?
Yeah.
When you were recording that, were you taking a lot of takes, or were you just kind of experimenting and letting things happen? Were there pleasant surprises in the studio?
Well, you know, I came from the world of jazz, basically, where the approach was improvisation. I mean, there was it was always in my consciousness. So, I mean, I didn't approach it like a pop star where you sort of determine everything, record it in the studio and everything, you know. We just sort of, I worked with a lot of good musicians and we just sort of went for it. You know, everything was like just sort of, it has a very alive feeling because most of those things were just sort of first takes. You know, it wasn't, it was sort of a rock and roll record, so the chords weren't very complex. You know, they're relatively simple structures, so I could just sort of give them chord charts and you just sort of jam it and, you know, and know you're going to get something good because the musicians are all excellent.
Had you been singing much up until this point?
Actually, I started out as a composer, essentially, and that's really how I envision myself. That's my sort of self-perception. I don't really see myself as a singer. But I was asked to start to sing my pieces to be on stage and by Paul Blay, who I was writing his book at the time, and I thought he thought that maybe it would be more profitable if there was a kind of a pretty girl on stage, you know,
yeah.
singing or something. But anyway, he sort of coerced me into doing that, and I never really felt comfortable being a front person. I'm sort of a behind-the-scenes kind of composing kind of person. But that's how it all got started, yeah.
And you actually had to figure out a way to put your voice through this Moog, didn't you?
Well, you know, when I I became very enthusiastic about working with this instrument. It's the first new instrument in 300 years, and so, you know, I was a young artist and, you know, very sort of enthusiastic about pioneering things and creating an identity, I suppose, as all young artists who are serious about what they do are. And so, I mean, you know, sort of kind of co-opted Paul into like going along with me on this journey, and but I envisioned that I would sort of be behind the curtain, you know, controlling the sounds and everything, because it was conceived for a keyboard instrument, and then I sort of thought about putting external things in, like drums and corns and things like that, and so I was going to sort of like be like the Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the curtain, you know, and I don't know, it just didn't seem to be a viable idea, and then I sort of thought about putting my voice through it, using it as an instrument to alter the sound of the voice as well, and had to invent a way to do that, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, how did you figure out how to even use this thing? I mean, you had a prototype, from what I understand, and like you said, the first new instrument in 300 years. Was that something that became frustrating for you, or was it invigorating, or...?
Well, it was very exciting, of course, but there wasn't any information around about, you know, how to use it. And, you know, there were a few people in New York that we went to see that had them, you know, were using them for jingles, you know, in the studio for commercials and things. But they weren't giving out any information. we just got the thing home, you know. I mean, we went to get it, and, you know, I said, we got to go get one, you know. And so Paul says, we have to take a station wagon. We have to bring it back tonight, you know. And so that was a really clever idea, and on the way down, I sort of psyched out what kind of rap would work on Robert Moog, and Paul presented the arguments, and it was effective, and we brought the synthesizer back. Once we got it home, we didn't know what to do with it, so we just put it in the closet for a while, you know, and behind this curtain, and when people came over, we'd draw the curtain back, and they'd say, what the blank is that, you know, a synthesizer, or what, you know, and so Yeah, so we just sort of, it was very daunting, you know, to think, to even, you know, the whole concept. I mean, it was a very analog world at the time, you know, so. And gradually we just sort of got it out and started, rolled up our sleeves and got to work and figured it out.
I'm looking for someone who
see.
Paul Blay and Annette Peacock with the song A Loss of Consciousness, recorded live for the record Blay Peacock Synthesizer Show, Revenge, The Bigger the Love, The Greater the Hate. The Moog synthesizer, for those unfamiliar with the instrument, was invented by Robert Moog and was intended for composing electronic music. You heard Miss Peacock explaining how they acquired one of these devices directly from the man himself. Robert Moog told Perfect Sound Forever's Jason Gross in March of 1997, quote, "I was never worried that synthesizers would replace musicians. First of all, you have to be a musician in order to make music with a synthesizer. And second, I never thought that analog synthesizer sounds would ever be mistaken for traditional musical instrument sounds. To me, the synthesizer was always a source of new sounds that musicians could use to expand the range of possibilities for making music," end quote. Annette Peacock met some challenges bringing the synthesizer on the road, an instrument she's likened in size to an airplane cockpit. She recalled her live experiences with the synthesizer during an interview with Impetus magazine in 1978, saying, quote, "The first gig we did was at the Village Vanguard, and we had to make the audience wait 20 minutes between tunes while we changed the patching. It was ridiculous. Anyway, it went on from there. We toured Europe and carried the stuff around. The Europeans weren't very happy because they were used to Paul as an acoustic player. We had a lot of trouble with it, and it didn't go down very well. Then my father died and left me $5,000, and I produced a concert at the Philharmonic Hall. I had Leonard Bernstein's dressing room. It was great. We did the first live concert with the synthesizer and voice. I used late-night TV to promote it. It was very cheap at the time, and we flashed pictures of synthesizers and things on the screen. And I didn't make any money. We broke even. When I drew back the curtain on the first night, there were some people out there. I was really astonished. I got some very good reviews, and we went on to do the albums and things," end quote. After 1973, Miss Peacock moved away from the synthesizer and into new territories. Not uncommon among artists, it would be 6 years before she released another record. And you guys hit the road with this thing to varying success depending on where you went. It was obviously troubling to move it around and such. And when you're done working, there's about 6 years until your next release, which was moved away from the Moog and into another area. What was the reason for the six-year gap between releases?
Well, I had a falling out with RCA, and I didn't have a contract anymore to record with them, and no reason to stay in New York, so I moved to Europe, and I don't know, I think I was kind of in a state of shock about everything, that a lot of things that happened, a lot of sort of major events in my life kind of very close together, and I think I was sort of traumatized by everything, and you know, I really was never pursuing a career. That was never my motivation. You know, I just like to solve problems with music. I like to, you know, I'm like more like a physicist. You know, I mean, I sort of approach it from the point of view that I have a hypothesis or something I wish to attempt, and then I have to figure out how to achieve it. You know, and that's what drives me. That's what motivates me. So, I mean, the career thing was kind of something that I never really focused on. So, I wasn't thinking about, I got to get a next record out, you know, or I have to, you know, what's the next step in my career, you know, things like that. I just sort of lived my life, and somehow I managed to get, you know, a few things out occasionally.
Relationship. So far, this is all there is. There is no place left to go, and I
I also read something about you working with Salvador Dali, but I couldn't find any real information on that. Could you care to elaborate on it?
Yeah, well, a friend of mine, he became interested in holograms, and he started to collaborate with Salvador Dali, and then I met him, I was introduced to him, and he asked me to be part of a holographic show that they were working on, and there was this hologram that was documented of me moving almost through time and space, and it was in the holographic museum for a while, and I was promised one, but then I left for Europe and never managed to follow it up and get one, but that was in a show on Broadway that he did with Salvador Dali.
Wild. Annette Peacock with No Winning, No Losing from 1983's Been in the Streets Too Long. Before that, Solar Systems off 1979's The Perfect Release. Thank you for tuning in to Connecting the Notes here on Valley Free Radio, streaming live at valleyfreeradio.org. We're devoting this hour to composer and musician Annette Peacock, who was kind enough to talk with the show earlier this week. Annette Peacock got her start working with Gary Peacock and soon Paul Blay. She composed a number of pieces that Blay performed in the late 60s to early 70s. Here's a part of my conversation with Annette talking about what drew her into music, We'll follow it up with a composition she wrote called Kid Dynamite, performed by Paul Blay, Barry Altschul, and Mark Levinson. So what was the first thing that kind of drew you into music? I mean, you mentioned you weren't going for it for a career, but then it kind of ended up happening. Was it composing, writing? You know, what was it that drew you in?
Well, you know, my mother was a classical musician, so I heard string quartets as I was falling into dreamland in the evening, and I went with her to the orchestra, the symphony orchestra, San Diego and Philharmonic, which she played. And so I think it was really part of the texture of my reality from the beginning. And I was left alone a lot as a child, and my mother would be working and playing symphonies, and there was a piano in the house. I started composing at four, and it became like a refuge to me, one of the most consistent relationships that I've ever had in my life. And so it's part of who I am, I think. I'm not sure I ever really had a choice, although I like to think I did.
The only two songs that I've known that you've covered have both been Elvis Presley songs. They're both definitely, you know, unique, very different takes on him. What's your draw towards Elvis Presley? Is that something that you also was from a childhood influence?
Yeah, I mean, there are those things that have, you know, in our when our consciousness is not cluttered by so many experiences, they have a huge impact in our formative years. And you know, Elvis was one of those people that kind of was an icon, you know, and a very strong figure in my youth. And you know, I just loved his voice, and really, I mean, those two songs, "Don't Be Cruel" and "Love Me Tender," are kind of iconic, like rock songs. Really, you know, I mean, they're just perfect little songs, and also, he has the same birthday as me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's
not the same year, but the same January. Also, David Bowie. We're all January 8th.
You ever been? Have you ever been down to Graceland?
I haven't. No.
I haven't either. But a friend just told me that he went down there, and there's actually about a 7-foot-tall marble statue of Elvis, and it's sitting on this base that's inscribed with the words Jesus. And
with the word what?
Jesus. And this was just a gift to Elvis while he was alive from his friends, and just kind of hanging out in the garden. So
he was very much loved. You know, I met him, actually.
You did?
Uh-huh. A couple of times. And, you know, he was exactly as he was purported to be. I mean, he was a Southern gentleman. You know, he was just a lovely person as well. I mean, from my experience with him, I met him at his house in Bel Air with some friends. He had a party, he didn't disappoint me. He was as I had expected him to be. So that's always nice.
Love me sweet. Never let me go. Have made my life complete, and I love you, and I love you so. Baby, love me tender, love me true. Thank you.
Annette Peacock performing the iconic Love Me Tender. During our interview, you may have heard me say that in Graceland, there's a statue of Elvis with the word Jesus inscribed at the bottom. That is actually incorrect. Upon further review, it's actually a statue of Jesus with the word Presley inscribed on the base that stands in the Garden of Graceland. So it's kind of an important distinction between those two. Let's move on to another part of the interview and more music by Annette Peacock. How have your approaches live differed over the years and the different styles that you kind of bounce around to? And do you find any of them, you know, any of your type of music more conducive to a live atmosphere or that you enjoy more?
Live is completely different than recorded. You know, I mean, in the recorded situation, you're dealing with the pure sound of something and you're trying to capture an expression. You have to go through the medium of technology, so it's sort of abstract, and live is very direct. You're dealing with an audience. But the problem is, I don't think in this, I mean, I may be wrong, but I sort of have the feeling that music has to be entertaining when you're doing a live situation. It's not necessarily a personal experience. When somebody buys a record, they take it home, they have a personal experience with it. Live is more of an entertainment kind of thing, and I've been doing solo when I've been performing the last few years, and there are certain territories where it works really well, like Italy and France and places like that. But if you're going to do Scandinavia or Germany or even Britain, I think you have to have some muscle, you have to have some dynamic dimension, which solo doesn't give you, and you know, to keep the focus. You can't be subtle, when you're performing solo. You can't. I don't think it works. It's too subtle for an audience.
So, do you generally enjoy it?
You know, I really don't like being. I'm not sort of one of these people that sort of love to be on stage, like the great performers and everything. I mean, so it's really hard for me to do that, but once I get in front of the keyboards and I play the first note, I get lost in it, and I'm okay, and I'm fine from then on, and I really, but it's such an artificial situation, you know, there you are at a certain time or something, and there are people there, and you're, you know, it isn't very, you know, I think I rail against the fact that it's such a pretentious, you know, circumstance, really. There's something about it that, but I think, you know, that, you know, I'm very sincere. I mean, I can't play the game, you know, I can't play the game, the entertainment game that people play. It's just me and basically I'm being transparent. I'm revealing myself, and that's kind of frightening, you know, I mean. You've got to do that. That's where the bravery comes in, and that's where the honesty comes in. It's only fair to the audience to give them a sincere performance. But it's, you know, some people love it and some people don't, you know. And I think it's good for, it's healthy for the music, because it's very important for you to get feedback to find out if what you're doing has any validity or not. You can sit alone in your room and you can compose and it could sound really good, but it may not mean anything or have any, you know, so that I really appreciate that, you know. You know, to have that, and I like meeting the people as well, because they're always sort of interesting people. People that sort of are drawn to my music. They're always sort of people that I would be interested in having as friends and knowing if the geography permitted. But it's not something that you know that compels me. You know, live performance or all those things that not, they don't draw. It's not my you know.
Yeah.
My goal in life to be seen and known and all those things that most people are motivated by.
The crocus is in bloom. Follow me away. it's almost spring.
Peacock discussed with Impetus magazine in 1978 the difference between her current composing ambitions compared to the time in her life when she was working with the synthesizer. She said, quote, "At the time I was trying to perform two functions, as a singer and lyricist and in using the voice as an instrument. And that was a bit confusing. It was difficult to do both things at once, but I'd always bite off more moderate these days and do a little bit less. The less you do, the easier it is for people to relate it. Actually, they pay you more to do less. You can't understand it. You want to give your all and do as much as you possibly can, but it doesn't work that way. But I was very young and very passionate, had all this energy, and I just wanted to do everything all at once. I was trying to make several points at the same time. I had a rock background with the voice, a free jazz background with the lyrics. I was trying to cover many territories at once. Now it's getting a little bit more focused. I'm feeling clearer about what I want to do in creating an environment for the voice and lyrics."
Mama never taught me how to cook. That's why I'm so skinny. Yeah, my mama never taught me how to clean. That's why I'm taught me how to cook, but my brother, he taught me how to eat. My daddy never taught me to succeed. That's why I'm so crazy. My daddy never taught me. I'm so unselfish. I'm not. my daddy never taught me to succeed, but my brother, he taught me how to turn the other cheek. Take your energy, absorb your vibe, and preach your philosophy. I want to become you. I want you, and I want you to die so I can be you. Hey, come over here and give your sweet vampire some blood. And I'm your man. Come over here and pay your landlord some dues. Hey, baby, that's what I call love. And that's what I call a relationship. Now, do you want to get it on? And I say, hey, man, my destiny's not to serve. I'm a woman. My destiny's to create.
When did you start your record label, Ironic?
I think it was 1981. In England, yeah.
How was the process, the experience having your own label been for you? Has it been enjoyable?
Well, it gave me the opportunity to sort of determine a lot more of, of the landscape of... how I work and what I want to do and musically and everything. So, and I really sort of like that possibility of being able to express myself on my own terms and my own ground. You know, I mean, every artist does, but it's a lot of work, and that's something that you have to factor in, because you have maybe less time to spend on the music, and you have to, although I don't really sort of, I'm not really one at promoting things either. I just, the last record I released, 3131, I broke my wrist just as I was releasing it, so I couldn't promote it. I couldn't do anything. It was my wrist was in a cast. I wasn't sure I'd ever play again. I'm going through this whole, drama thing about it, and then the record just started selling, and I was like, how are people finding out about it? I haven't notified anybody, I haven't sent it out. I said, I thought to myself, well, I'm just not going to promote it. I'm just going to, like, you know, I'm just going to go with this and see what happens. And, like, and it was really, really beautiful for me, because it was like I knew everybody who bought the record, you know, and I knew where it was going, and it went to places that I never even heard of, you know. I mean, it was like really astounding, really surprising, very entertaining, actually. You know, sort of, I'm not one to sort of promote and do things like that. I don't elicit anything, really. I don't elicit any performances or any publicity or promotion or anything. I just, you know, I think it sort of lacks grace, although it's strange because I'm living in a world where everybody is self-promoting, you know, and watching all that happen, it's kind of intriguing. And
what would you like to, you know, not that you're one to promote, but would you like to say anything about the compositions you're working on now, or would you rather surprise us sometime down the road?
Yeah, I mean, they're just sort of, they're in utero, so to speak. I mean, I really don't, you know, it's like when I gave birth to my child and she was finally tangible and in front of me, I said, so this is who you are. I mean, it's like, it's part of the creative process, and sometimes I sort of decide that, you know, this is what I want to do, but, I mean, how in the world do I get here, and that's the challenge, and other times I just sort of create and let the thing unfold, you know, let it take me where it wants to go, and that's sort of the process that I'm in right now. So I really don't, I'm not sure where I'm it's going to take me.
I love my pony.
Thank you all for joining us this hour as we listen to the music of Annette Peacock. We'd like to thank Annette for taking the time to talk with the show, and thank all the support from the listeners out there who support this show and Valley Free Radio as a whole. We'll be back next week, 8 o'clock, right here on 103.3 FM. Good night.